Previously on the Philanthropist Conversation, we were in New York, a city that flips the European model where politics leads and business follows. The streets of Manhattan revealed that private money and philanthropy hold potential for heat resilience, driving innovation, championing new forms of social architecture. Philanthropy is forward-thinking. And when key actors come together, a lot can change in record time, which is good because temperatures are rising in record time. Across the world, including in the global north, heat is about to become something we live with up to 6 months of the year. In Florida or Greece, that's already a reality. So what does that mean for our way of life? For our final episode, I'm taking you to a place of extreme heat, where architectural design and sustainability are taking leaps. This is the Philanthropist Conversation. Welcome to Abu Dhabi. I'm Paula Silverfield. I'm an environmental scientist based in London. In this series, we've traveled the world to talk about urban heat. And now it's time to find out what the future holds when heat becomes our day-to-day. This is the final episode of our series on heat, and it's a big one. So buckle in. One last stop. Off we go. Today we begin not outside, but in the cool Mandarin Oriental Lounge, a gorgeous wing of the Emirates Palace. Arch ceilings, chandeliers, mazrabiya windows, and a view of luxurious Oriental gardens. This tea room is a sight to behold. Shukran, is this, what kind of tea is this?
It's karak with saffron, madame. It's very, very popular. Strong black tea, cardamom, saffron, and a little condensed milk.
Mmm, smells lovely. It's rich.
Yes, yes, spiced and slightly sweet. Enjoy it.
So I know what you're thinking. Paula, what are you doing ordering tea when it's 40 degrees outside? Well, if the locals do it, so can I. In London, I'd probably be reaching for a nice coffee, but this feels right. Plus, truth be told, this lounge gives nothing away of the heat outside. There's something almost surreal about Abu Dhabi's climate. It's like the air shimmers with warmth. The sun is so powerful. Touring the city today is going to be a different ballgame, but I won't be deterred. There is so much to see here. I wouldn't know where to start. Fortunately, I've got someone who can help with that.
Miss Paula, assalamu alaikum. We are honored to have you here. Truly, welcome to Abu Dhabi.
Thank you, Hamdan. It's a real privilege. And what a place to rendezvous.
Yes, we thought it would set the tone. A little grandeur never hurts, you know?
Well, it definitely makes an impression. I've just sat down with tea. Would you like to join me?
Oh, yes, of course. Never rush tea time.
Couldn't have said it better myself. This, dear listeners, is Hamdan Al-Suwaidi. Hamdan was born and raised in Abu Dhabi. He is an Al-Suwaidi. His family is eminent here in the Emirates. They're known for contributing to politics, business, culture, and the arts. So if someone can tell me about the history of Abu Dhabi, it's Hamdan. So tell me, Hamdan, I know you work for the United Emirates government. What is it that you do exactly?
I am a senior advisor in government. So day in, day out, my job is to consult with authorities on major urban projects. Think homes, public buildings, road networks, that kind of thing. I specialize in sustainability. Everything that touches renewable energy and infrastructure, that's my purview.
Well, Hamdan, that's so on brand for this podcast.
We thought so, yes. That's why when you got in touch, you were directed to me. You see, when someone comes from so far away to visit, we have to make that count. You have been traveling for a while, right? You were in New York before.
Correct. It's a little surreal to be here now, honestly. I flew in from New York JFK, first to Dubai, stopped to see some landmarks. I actually went to the Museum of the Future. I'm sure you've heard of it.
Ah, yes, a favorite of mine.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it showcases the best of science and technology. And when you are there, you can imagine the world of the future. Sustainable cities, AI hospitals, reinforced domes on Mars. It's like a thought experiment about what humanity could be.
100%. Even just the building, it's all glass and steel. It's like its own little capsule.
You could be in space, right?
Totally. It's just a shame I don't speak Arabic. I couldn't read all the inscriptions on the facade.
Ah, well, I can help with that. They are all quotes about design, technology, and the future of human life. One of them reads, "The future belongs to those who can imagine it, design it, and execute it. It isn't something you await, but rather create." And to me, that's nearly spiritual.
Oh yeah, I see. It's like a creation myth.
Yes, you know, here our religion is Islam, and there's a history of bringing together science and spirituality. I mean, think about the Islamic Golden Age and everything that emerged from it. Philosophy, maths, astronomy.
Of course. So innovative design is like a tradition, nearly.
Exactly, yes.
I think in Europe throughout history, science and religion have sort of butted heads. But you're saying here, you've kept the two intertwined.
Absolutely. I like to say we have skipped past the loss of faith chapter of history and launched straight into Islamic futurism.
Islamic futurism?
Don't worry. You will see what I mean today. There is a lot to discover.
Well, maybe it's time to get going then.
Yep, sure. Ready when you are.
Islamic futurism. We're coining terms on this podcast today. That's a first. But seriously, Hamdan works so closely with the UAE government. He really understands Abu Dhabi's vision. He knows the details and the big picture. So together, we're going to measure the scale of the city and find out how it balances ancestral design and high technology. We're going to grasp the essence of what Islamic futurism is. And so, our tour today starts with some sightseeing. Let's see what happens when tradition and innovation are used to build a hyper-modern city like Abu Dhabi. So, we've just entered central Abu Dhabi, and whoa, it's busy around here.
Yeah, right? There's a lot going on in Al Husn. This is where we are now. It's one of the main pedestrian areas of Abu Dhabi. So locals love to come here for a stroll. You have got libraries, cultural spaces, shops.
It's like a town within a town.
Yes, and you've got some prime examples of our heritage too.
Amazing. That will be a change from the skyline of the Corniche. That's where my hotel is, by the seafront.
Oh yes, it's very contemporary there.
Yeah, yeah.
Meanwhile, in this part of town, it's a bit more of a mix. The area was the original urban core of Abu Dhabi. Before the skyscrapers and the planned expansion of the city. In fact, this is where it all started.
Wow, okay. So for our listeners, we're in front of an all-white building in the style of traditional Middle Eastern architecture. It's squarish and there's a courtyard on the inside. You've got two stories with beautiful arches and open corridors to walk in the shade. It looks like a palace, but then in the background, you've also got the skyline. Impossible to forget where you are. So what is this place, Hamdan?
You are looking at the oldest building in Abu Dhabi. Qasr al-Husn, or Qasr al-Husn. In some ways, the city literally grew around this building, or at least this neighborhood did. This is the ancestral seat of the ruling family.
Wow, okay.
It's also a living reminder of traditional heat design. Do you want to see it up close?
Absolutely.
So we are now walking through a covered breezeway. This is pretty typical here. You've got a nice shaded corridor to walk through and some seating alcoves. Not bad, is it?
No, you're right. It is pleasantly fresh here.
That's because the building is made of stone, coral and sea stone. If you want to check it out, go ahead. Touch it, it's cool. Stone doesn't permit heat, so it's it's a very good natural insulator.
So nice. The building has very small windows as well. Is that for installation too?
Yes, and to maintain privacy. But the main reason is to keep cool. You've also got the Mishrabia screens here. Great for letting air in while creating shade.
Of course. Just for listeners, the mashrabiyas are these wooden screens. They're usually associated with Oriental design. You can divide a room with them or put them against your windows, and they're carved out to let in a little light.
Like a stencil.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. You know, I've noticed, whether it was Dubai or Abu Dhabi, there's a habit here of creating shade everywhere.
Yes, this is Middle Eastern architecture 101. Anything to not bake under the sun.
Masters of shade.
Yeah, shade sheikhs, in fact. But yes, what we want above all is to have shade all throughout the day. Now, historically, buildings were built close together, and streets have a lot of twists and turns. Then, with more modern insulations, we learned to create shade differently. So, for example, we will join our rooftops with shading structures. Things like that. Oh, also, on the corniche, did you see the Al-Bahar towers?
Yes. They're shaped like pineapples, right?
Absolutely. Well, what gives them this look is a new kind of high-tech mishrabia. So all around the building, you have got these dynamic screens equipped with sensors. They open and close throughout the day to follow the sun, and the building becomes more efficient. You don't have to use nearly as much energy to cool down.
Very cool. So about ventilation, I imagine that when it comes to urban design, creating airflows is fairly important.
Oh yeah, absolutely. The main thing is you want the air to zigzag. That's how you can create a breeze. Our streets are designed to enhance that. Oh, another thing we use for ventilation are wind catchers. Have you ever heard of them?
No, not at all.
So in Arabic, we call these barjil. They are towers that are built with, at the top, large square windows, for a lack of better words. They are just an opening that can catch the natural movement of the air. Winds are then redirected down the tower and keeps moving throughout the building.
Wow, okay. So it doesn't use electricity or water at all, right?
That's it.
It's just good old physics.
You find these wind towers everywhere in the Gulf region. It's very old-fashioned, but now they are making a comeback. With the tech we have access to, we can build really high-rise towers, something we wouldn't really do back in the 1900s.
That's really cool.
Oh, look, on the right here. Shall we sit down, actually?
Sure. So I meant to ask you this before, but there's a real tradition of designing with the environment here, right? We tend to assume that sustainability is a new idea in the Emirates, but maybe it's misguided?
Yeah, I would say so. I think the assumption is that we are out here saying, hey, let's build the next New York for a new Hong Kong. But we know that wouldn't work here. We have different needs. People have been living here for centuries, you know. We have a history with heat resilience, and that's our foundation. The Middle East has always been a place of adaptation. So the indigenous techniques that made us grow as a region, they are not going away.
I hear you. And I think what's been, I suppose, held up against that is the wealth made from the oil industry. That's not exactly sustainable, which doesn't take away from what you've just said, but it tips the scale.
I mean, yes, understandably so, but we are in an interesting position. In the UAE, we don't really see oil as the future. Oil means abundance now, but in 50 years, it will be gone. We want to build something that lasts. So how do we do that? Well, we find abundance elsewhere. That's why we want to go big on technology and sustainability now. And I should say, it's not just the UAE. Qatar and Saudi, they also have that goal. In the Gulf region, we are built on sand. We don't wait for things to fall apart. We get ahead of the next challenge. So right now, the world sees us as oil money. But our focus is on sustainable innovation, actually. That's the future.
What Hamdan is saying here kind of blows my mind. It just changes my perspective and my expectations. The UAE has always contended with heat and aridity. It's a desert environment, yes, but one that holds deep wisdom and adaptive intelligence. So the Gulf region is the birthplace of heat resilience, but now it could also be its future. And the future isn't just a destination, it's a responsibility. Now, according to Hamdan, this attitude to heat resilience is a heritage of Muslim culture. And that intrigues me. I mean, Islamic futurism, faith and heat resilience going hand in hand? That needs further explaining. So with a quick cab ride, our city guide takes us to a place that will speak to this idea.
Allah yisalmak, ma qassart. Ma'a salama, bye.
Thank you, have a great day.
Paula, welcome to the Grand Mosque.
Whoa, straight out of the Arabian Nights.
I know. It's beautiful, isn't it?
Very impressive. Is it insensitive to say it reminds me of the Taj Mahal?
I can see it. They are both great examples of Islamic architecture, and the dome roofs look quite alike. There is so much more to this place, though. Let me show you. These are the reflecting pools. They go all around the mosque, and the water nearly looks like a mirror. But see how nice and fresh it is when you walk along?
I know, it's stunning. I feel like it's not just about convenience. It's beautiful and it's kind of asking you to slow down.
To reflect? Well, yeah. Reflection, tafakkur, is actually a spiritual act in Islam. The mosque is designed for it.
Mm-hmm. So, Hamdan, I think this is a good segue to discuss your religion. Can you say more about Muslim traditions and their cultural impact?
Of course, sure. So, Islam, like many other religions, is centered around belief in one God, Allah. That word literally means God. Although, fun fact, Allah is neither a feminine or masculine, because God is not a man or a woman. They are all encompassing.
I love that.
We practice Islam with five core practices, what we call the five pillars. They are basically a stage-by-stage rulebook to practice the Muslim faith.
Okay, I get it. So, what are the big five?
So, first, shahada, is declaring your faith in God. Then, salah, prayer, practice your faith.
And you pray several times a day, right?
Yes, five times a day, and always towards Mecca. So, commit, pray, and then give zakah, charity. Sharing is caring, you know? Our faith pillars also symbolizes fasting. Muslims must fast in the month of Ramadan. This is a way to connect with those who have less. We don't just share our goods, we also step into their shoes.
Oh, I see. Oddly, I always thought Ramadan was about self-discipline. You know, kind of like Lent.
It's also about discipline, but more so it's an act of empathy. Anyways, finally, the fifth pillar is making the pilgrimage to our holy city, Mecca. This is something every Muslim must do at least once. Mecca is important because it's where Muhammad was born. And he is the prophet, the messenger of Allah. Besides the Quran, Muhammad's word and the description of his life are the most important Muslim texts. His life and story build the foundations for how we Muslims live. So you could say Muhammad was a social thinker. He created communities and social systems, and his values and visions are an inspiration for our ruling sheikhs, still today.
Aha. I'm starting to see how that can take us back to heat resilience. So from your perspective, when we talk about urban heat or designing the future of our cities, in the Middle East, much of that is also shaped by Islam.
That's right. Let's walk through the country yard. You have to see this.
Wow. We're walking across this marble plaza, and there are carvings into the stone, these amazing flower patterns.
And if you look across,
yeah,
under the domes, you have pillars with the same ornaments, as well as inscriptions from the Quran.
Oh, very symbolic. The literal pillars of Islam.
Exactly.
The atmosphere is suddenly quite different. The light is warm and golden here.
Yes, this is the interior of the mosque. Actually, if we continue further down this way, we will approach the prayer hall. It's a place for contemplation and prayer. So we will have to be quiet.
Is this okay?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, great. So from what you were saying, it sounds like Islam offers this tool set for your way of life, but does it change how you look at political issues?
I would say yes. Islam has always been about reimagining humanity, uniting people, even in the face of uncertainty. I think when people hear submission to Allah, they react with fear. But we are not actually so much about rigid law. Many Muslims want to move away from that and towards what we call akhlaq.
So what does that stand for?
It's spiritual ethics, virtue, if you will. It means dedicating yourself to good, embodying wisdom. So it's not just about obeying. It's more about being responsible for the good of others. It might seem abstract, but this philosophy has very real practical implications. My job as a Muslim and as a member of society is to respond to suffering, to beauty, to life with responsibility. In a heat crisis, that means creating space where people can live well, looking after their needs and being mindful for what comes next.
You know, this reminds me, I don't know a ton about Islam, but I'd heard about the idea of stewardship. Something about being the stewards of the earth, so looking after our environment. That seems to tie back to what you're saying.
Absolutely. We call this khalifa. Stewardship means being connected, devoted to one another. But it's not just about relationships. Stewardship is also about planning and organizing resources.
So to you, Islam is both a philosophy and like a method?
Exactly. It's because of Muslim cultures that we are building a future where technology, ecology, and ethics are braided together. We want to make more with less, organize our resources, take care of each other. You know?
Well, that's big. I mean, there was a lot in there. But what's really hitting me today is that culture and faith matter when it comes to social change. Our beliefs shape our behaviors. So if we want to live differently, we need to start by connecting with people's values. We need to align heat resilience with cultural philosophies. That's not just true here in the Gulf states. To generate an appetite for change worldwide, we have to speak to what people understand, how they live, and what matters to them. In short, turn change into something relatable, something local and known.
You know, Paula, the Quran itself says, "We made you into nations and tribes so that you may know one another." That means that there are multiple ways of knowing. And when we welcome this pluralism, we can open new doors.
This makes me think, in places like Europe, it's clear that there's already a history with heat. I mean, around the Mediterranean Sea, in Greece or Italy or Spain, you have shaded street corridors. It's not so different. But it's like our approach to heat is less unified. It's like we haven't learned from one another.
Well, yeah, you are not thinking about heat holistically. That's the thing. You are seeing Italy and Greece and the south of France and Spain and Turkey and even Syria as different entities. And culturally, that's absolutely valid. But if you want to have a heat-resilient system, consider your shared history. Catalog all the different heat techniques and then scale them to your needs. I am talking about Europe here, but it's true everywhere. Let's think beyond borders. Heat is a global question.
I agree, yeah. It's becoming more urgent too. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but the World Resources Institute recently mapped out heat-vulnerable cities. It's not looking great.
I am sure.
There are cities at risk of extreme heat in every part of the world. Mediterranean cities, Latin American cities, parts of Africa and the southern US too. All of these places are being compared to the Middle East.
Well, and it's funny because from our side, we have been comparing ourselves to the rest of the world for a long time. In fact, we have been asking for the attention of the world leaders to share what we know. That's why we host the COP28 in Dubai, for example.
That was a surprise for a lot of people.
And it shouldn't have been. I mean, we have been talking about sustainability since the early 2000s. Abu Dhabi hosts a sustainability week every year, has done since 2007. It's meant to be a global platform. We convene with climate policymakers, industry leaders, and innovators. We also have the World Future Energy Summit. And we were the first country to design a city from top to bottom with sustainability and heat resilience in mind.
Oh, wow, really?
Yes, yes. Have you ever heard of Masdar?
Oh my God, yes, of course. I can't believe I didn't put two and two together. A major British architecture firm was involved in that, right?
Yes, Foster and Partners. They did some brilliant work. Actually, I could take you there if you want. It's a suburb of Abu Dhabi and it's on the way to the airport.
Really? That would be amazing. Actually, there's someone else I'm meeting today and I think this would be right up his street. Mind if I tell him to come? He'd be joining us later.
Sure, just this way.
Before we dive into the world of Masdar, I want to tell you more about this case study in heat resilience. The idea behind Masdar was simple: create a city where temperatures are 5 to 10 degrees cooler than the surrounding desert. When it was commissioned back in 2007, leading designers and engineers were brought on board to turn the vision into a reality. And I happen to know one of the architects who worked on this project. So let's press pause on our city tour and take a short break for a history lesson. Introducing our very own Masdar Encyclopedia, Gerard Evenden.
I'm Gerard Evenden. I'm a senior executive partner at Foster & Partners.
You might not know it, but you're probably familiar with the work of Foster & Partners, the Gherkin and the Millennium Bridge in London, the Hearst Tower in New York City, Hong Kong's International Airport. Foster's and Partners has contributed to iconic landmarks across the world. The firm is known for its innovative approach to architecture. A project like Masdar was no exception. So Gerard, can you tell us about the roots and ambitions of this project?
Yeah, so back 2007, a long time ago now, we received a letter out of the blue from the government department in Abu Dhabi saying that they were thinking about this sustainable city. I went down to Abu Dhabi and there was a group of just two or three people in the room. And they said, look, we want to build this city. It's going to be zero carbon, zero waste. But actually, at the time, nobody really understood what that meant. There was no definition of it. And actually, all over the world, there were people who were looking at little pieces of the jigsaw. So we went around and we sort of, if you like, cobbled together this group of people as a team. And there was a big driving force and encouragement from the Abu Dhabi government for us to actually get on and make something happen. And not only happen, but happen very quickly. So we had a sort of 2.5 year window that we were going to create a place that people could talk about that was called Masdar. And that was the start of the journey.
So I know you had a very talented team with different skills and specialities. How was it working together? Did people ever, you know, butt heads?
Oh, there were loads of different temperaments. I think there was plenty of argument and there was a huge enthusiasm.
Yeah, I mean, there's something really exhilarating about breaking new grounds. So how did you get started? I mean, I know that you did your research, but once you were physically on the ground, was it a SimCity situation? Like, we have this space, let's start building from scratch? Or what was your plan there?
Well, I think we came up with this idea of this square. We had a 7 square kilometre site and we had about 6 million square metres of accommodation to put on it. And actually, the square was quite evocative because it also kind of, when you looked at some of the historic cities, they were very regular shapes. And the square would sit on the site and the square was not taking up all the land. And that there was this story about, could we support that much development on the site?
Gerard and his team had to balance the amount of land they had for the development with the space needed to support the design. That brings up a number of questions, like, for example, if you want renewable energy to power the whole city, how much of it do you need? Where do you produce it? A lot to think through, for sure, but Gerard has a method.
First of all, looking at the arrangement of buildings one against another, looking at the overall arrangement of the city, and then looking at the next layer, which was the cladding systems and the layering of the buildings themselves and the types of buildings and how one building related to another. And then eventually the energy collection, whether it was solar, geothermal, and all of that work went on.
So, three stages of space design. Stage one, consider the foundations of your city. How will one building relate to another? What is the passive relationship between all the natural elements? Stage two, how do you layer up? With extreme heat, you have to consider shading. If you've topped your building up with the right kind of facades and roofs, you won't need much energy to cool them down. So get these two fundamentals right, and you're already making the most of your land capacity. Now, to go back to Masdar's design, Jared had to think about transportation.
We lifted the city up onto a deck, and we had an area under below the deck where vehicles could move around in an autonomous way, not with tracks, but using GPS and tracking where they were with satellites and so on. Above the ground, in the streets, those streets became pedestrianised, and that allowed us to push the streets together because they were pedestrian streets, and that allowed us to have smaller spaces, more shading, and hence the city began to develop.
And remember, this was 17 years ago, but Foster and partners could see that automated transports were the way forward. In fact, their vision was advanced in more ways than one. Going back to the deck, it had a couple of advantages for evaporative cooling, right? Can you say more about that?
Yeah, it says the Middle East lacks water. And so we have to use water sparingly. But actually, a small amount of water can have quite a big effect on the feeling of coolth. And the word, interestingly, the word Masdar means the source. But the interesting thing was what the deck allowed us to do was also create great big planting areas for trees. But if you plant a tree in the desert soil, you need a lot of water to make it work. However, if you create a big pot and you can effectively put all the necessary fertilized soils and so on, you can reduce the amount of water you're using to grow your tree. So by creating the deck, we were also creating an environment whereby plantation was going to be much easier. We could control the amount of water we were using. We could choose the right type of water-resilient plants, which needed to be indigenous, and something that would thrive. And that happened. I think the other interesting thing is that we talked a lot about felt temperature on your body. And what we found was that the felt temperature on the same day in Masdar City was about 10 degrees lower than in the centre of Abu Dhabi itself.
That's incredible. Another example of innovation was how you source sustainable energy for Masdar. We mentioned it before, but you saved a portion of your land capacity for energy facilities. I mean, before Masdar, sustainable energy meant putting solar panels on buildings or wind turbines, that kind of thing. How did you go about this?
So there was a big debate about, was it right to put these collectors onto the buildings, or should there be a solar field? Interestingly, because we had the land around Masdar that we'd saved, we built a 10 megawatt solar field. And it was very interesting because once we'd done that, we realized that actually there was a reason that utilities historically had been separated from buildings, because it was very easy to run. And because we could access them, because we could clean them easily, we were getting maximum capacity out of them. And we weren't putting heat into the city. You know, utilities could be handled as utilities and power could just be pumped into a grid, which was taking us back to, if you like, the grid of the fossil fuel, but it was renewable.
And it seems like Masdar had a legacy. I mean, I know the United Emirates have since built a very large solar power station around Abu Dhabi, Shams 1 and 2.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'll give you an example. So we've been, for the last 14 years, we're working on the National Museum, the Zayed National Museum in Abu Dhabi. I think it started towards the end of the Masdar process. And that is the first naturally ventilated museum. It relies on a labyrinth underneath it that pulls air into the building. It's sunken into the ground. It has solar thermal towers. And that really has encapsulated some of the real learning that was made at Masdar.
What a testament to Foster and Partners' craft. There's a fundamental belief here that urban design stems from a local climate and history of practice, not the other way around.
I think here at Foster's, there's always been an emphasis on the science of architecture. You can't design great buildings unless you've stood on the ground where they're going to be. You have to experience the place, and that generates the architecture. And that's a very important piece of what we're trying to do. You know, the challenge is not forgetting what we had before and combining that with the opportunities for the future. This, again, is part of the evolutionary process of design, that we can never stand still. There's great innovation occurring. And I think in these areas of extreme, where people are pushing innovation, the rest of the world really needs to watch and focus and catch up. Because if it doesn't catch up, it'll find itself behind.
Hear that? Masdar is not just an experiment, it's a blueprint, a place where the best of smart technology is leveraged with local history, where creative minds have built systems that perform beautifully under pressure. But more than that, Masdar invites other cities and global powers to ask, how do we design for the future? So with that, maybe it's time we saw this place for ourselves, don't you think? Oh, is this the maquette of the city?
Yes, yes, of course. It doesn't look like this yet. A lot of it is still being built around the visitor center, where we are now. But see that orange building in the middle? If you look up, just outside the window here.
Ah, yes, it's right here. Oh, and do you see the man in a suit walking by just now? That's Ivan. Ivan, in here.
Oh, hi.
Ivan, Hamdan, this is my boss, Ivan Peter.
Great to meet you, Ivan.
And you, it's a pleasure. Paula tells me you can show us around today?
So, confession time. Much of this podcast has been a traveling journal to document my findings on heat resilience. You all know this, but none of it would have been possible without the support of one person, and that person is Ivan Peter. Ivan is the founder of Pegasus, an organization I've been working with for a little over a year. Ivan's deepest passion and mission is to build resilience on a global scale. He wants to take it to the next level. He doesn't just have heat in mind. Pandemics, access to food, to energy, there's a lot Ivan is working on. With Pegasus, he funds new initiatives and helps design the cities of tomorrow, places where new social architecture makes our environment viable. Phew, I know, big mission. But if someone's got the drive for it, it's Ivan. We were going to meet at the airport today to fly back to London together, but knowing him, I thought visiting Masdar was a must. So we're now in what is technically the suburb of Abu Dhabi, but Masdar is its own thing, right?
Correct. Masdar City.
And it's pretty small, things considered. I mean, not the buildings. The architecture is impressive and clearly designed to accommodate many. But the city is very walkable.
Yes, that's very deliberate. See, Masdar was built on this idea of centralization, efficiency. We wanted to bring services together and make sure that wherever you are in Masdar, you have easy access. Here you are already in the residential block, but you also have your healthcare center. The local mosque, offices, supermarkets, and restaurants.
Hmm, interesting. That's the idea of the five-minute city, right? As a Londoner, let me tell you, this sounds like a dream.
Yes, it's really convenient. Where we are now, you could call it the city center, geographically at least. It's central, but as the city grows, we will get more of these urban cores. So it won't be like everyone needs to move towards the city center every day.
It's a very different setup for urban life. And you know, I do quite a bit of traveling myself. But I think this is the first car-free city I've ever seen.
Well, welcome to the future then. Let's take a turn here. I want to show you the university.
Oh, wait. What is this?
Oh, that's the Masdar Institute Wind Tower.
Oh, so do you mean a real-life Tajil? Tajil?
Barjil, yes. Though, as you can tell, this one is very contemporary.
Oh, are you guys talking about that metal tower?
Yes, it's a wind catcher, a tower that catches the wind and helps ventilate the city. It was inspired by indigenous architecture.
Ah, okay. I clearly missed a chapter. So, Hamdan, why does it look like there's mesh wrapped around the tower?
This helps capture and redirect air movement. Look, we can stand beneath it, so you can see.
Oh, it's like a very tall tube?
Pretty much. Traditionally, wind catchers are completely analog. But this Barjil is a little different. It's got captors that can tell which way the wind is blowing. And the structure orients its windows to collect as much air as possible.
Fascinating. So then, the wind moves down the tower?
Precisely. That's why it's quite fresh here. Do you feel it?
Mm-hmm. It's really pleasant.
The trick is, it's not just wind. About midway through the tower, you have got humidity sensors that release a mist if the air is too hot. Very little amounts, we don't want to waste, but in this way, we benefit from the water cooling effect.
So it's like a highly efficient AC?
Kind of, yes. Obviously, that wasn't the original design of Barjil back in the 19th century, but it's one of the ways in which technology can enhance where we are now. See over there?
Where the street takes a turn?
Yes, this is the start of a little maze of buildings. And the wind from the tower is funneled directly into the maze.
Ingenious. I'm starting to think nothing was left to chance here.
Oh, no, no.
Right, right.
Come on, just this way. So this building is the Mohammed bin Zayed University of Artificial Intelligence. It's a research institute dedicated to AI. I mean, as we just saw, there's a lot of potential to use transformative technologies for environmental causes. And in Masdar and Abu Dhabi more broadly, we are keen to advance that expertise. Use it for good. We are really thinking about this as a fourth industrial revolution. Much of Masdar is actually a student campus at the moment. The main buildings are further up north.
Oh, okay. Does that mean that the city doesn't have its own community yet? And by that I mean, you know, people who just come here because they want to live in Masdar, same as Dubai or Abu Dhabi?
Yeah, ish, for now. Masdar only has a population of around 15,000 people. And there is more capacity, definitely, but you can't really compare it to our bigger cities.
But it's been a while since Masdar has been operational, right?
You know, the cold hard truth is, I am not sure that Masdar really stands on its own, currently. And I don't mean physically, of course. It's very structurally sound, but it's not yet part of the Emirates' zeitgeist.
Yeah, I can see why. It's a common issue for recent cities. As people, we're drawn to the feeling of a local culture, and that takes time to build. We choose a city not because of a perfect lifestyle. It's more about the history, the identity of the place. I mean, ask any New Yorker why they live in New York. The air is not clean, everything is expensive, people live on top of each other, the city isn't even built for you to make your own food. But it's not about your quality of life, really. New York is a world that you want to be a part of. It's New York or nothing.
That's exactly right. Let's continue down this way. So we are just around the corner from the visitor center again. Before we go back, shall we sit down for coffee here? Take a quick break.
Sure.
I will go order. You just take a seat.
Ah, it's nice to sit down.
Tired from the day?
Starting to feel it, yeah. It's all of the traveling and the heat today, I think. Though Masdar has been quiet and shaded. It's a nice respite.
Here you go. Gahwa and dates. A classic treat. Gahwa is a coffee flavored with cardamom and other spices.
Mmm, lovely.
So Hamdan, well, just to finish on what we were saying, today, you'd say Masdar still has some aging to do. It's like a baby city.
Correct, but it's not the full picture. You know, I think somewhere along the way, there was probably some wishful thinking on our part. When we commissioned the project, it was back in 2000s. The UAE was not known for sustainability at all. So with Masdar, We wanted to enter the world stage and bring big players to the table. That's you guys, Western powers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And don't take this the wrong way, but I think that led us to build a city with a Western lens, not a Middle Eastern lens. I mean, the people who worked on Masdar were fantastic. Many people can live here comfortably, but the city is banking on that idea of scarcity of means. And now, environmentally, it needed to be done. No doubt about it. But the Emirati mindset at present, it's not a scarcity mindset, you see.
Oh, so I suppose there's a tension there, a clash of expectations?
Exactly. When you come from the Emirates, you are used to a ton of space. You want a house, a garden, it's a culture of abundance. And I think for people who aren't students, for locals who want to settle, build a life and a family, Masdar feels a little small and dense. So that's where we still need to do the work. We have to find a way to integrate that sustainable mindset.
You know, so much can be done to facilitate that, though. Community and proximity can be delightful and desirable. They just need to be cultivated, or even glamorized, I guess. There are different ways to bridge that gap.
I could not agree more. Again, that's like New York. You get attached to the proximity. The other thing is, when Masdar opened, it was a little bit sensational. But then the attention from the international community faded. So maybe we need to redefine what Masdar is for. Okay, it's not the new Middle Eastern city, but it's still a blueprint for what a sustainable city can be. That's huge.
Yes, I hope so. You know, even I like to think that Masdar was just the first. So it was a testing ground of sorts. And truth be told, it's inspired countless other projects. For example, you have got the similar development in the northwest of Saudi Arabia. It's called NEOM, if you ever want to look it up. But yeah, it's a win.
See, there you go. I think Masdar's power is that it answers some cutting-edge questions about heat management. It looks at natural resources differently. It considers technology in new ways, like how do we build beautifully and efficiently with limited resources? How do we reimagine cities that survive the heat and build intelligence around it?
I am glad that that's the impression you get from being here, because I agree. Masdar feels like this prototype that we can learn from.
Funny you use the word prototype. I was going to say, to me, it feels like Masdar itself is a new technological object.
Quite the gadget you've got there, Paula.
But you know what I mean, right? It's nearly like when you build a spaceship, it's a big old gadget that you launch into the cosmos. But the thing itself is a revolution for the scientific community. Masdar is the same.
I love the way you put that. And you guys want to know something funny?
Always.
Well, for some of the buildings in Masdar, we actually drew inspiration from space technology.
Wouldn't you know?
I know, you've got good instincts. So, the lunar module, for instance, on the moon, it's extremely cold, not hot. But the principles are the same. So, we learned from spatial engineering, and then we used the thick installation and reflective foils to create very stable indoor environments. Having said that, if I may, I think from our point of view, when nation leaders or even people, when anyone sees Masdar, we don't want it to be a spectacle anymore. We don't want it to be like we are going to space, woo. Masdar should be an inspiration. We want our visitors to think, okay, we can push boundaries, we can take on this work. Because if we can make it here, you can make it anywhere.
Take that, New York. Just kidding, but seriously, projects like Masdar are undeniably setting the tone for a new age of design. The scale of the innovation is almost a work of science fiction, or at least that's how it feels when you're not from here. But the thing that gets me is, you can't build a place like Masdar on hypotheticals. I mean, the solutions we saw today, they're not for in 5, 10, or 20 years. They're already here. They've been around since 2007. If they can work in 40 degrees Abu Dhabi, then they should be fine in 30 degrees London. Ooh, after being outside, this blast of aircon is something else.
I see what you mean. It's a shock to the system, but pleasant, I hope, eh?
And everything's powered by renewables here, right? So it's guilt-free.
Very true that. So we're now back at the Masdar City Visitor Center, and Hamdan, it's nearly time for us to part ways. There's so much we discussed together today, I could not thank you enough for taking us around.
Oh, you are very welcome.
Truly, it was fascinating to hear about what you do here in Abu Dhabi. I mean, I still can't believe you use space tech here. It's like the climate is so harsh that we need to think of it as this inhospitable environment and gear up. It's just striking.
No, I know what you mean. Extreme heat means you've got a lot of constraints. You need to work with modularity. That's how space tech is built. And that's why it works here.
That's right. With global warming, that's probably where a lot of places are going.
Mm-hmm. In some ways, it's like we need to reimagine life on Earth. Think of it as this new planet we're discovering.
Well, yeah, and my ancestors might resent me for that, but it's probably time to stop looking up at the stars and start looking around us. Let's focus on what we have. Heat is already here. That's why in the Middle East, we feel like we have a duty to share what we know.
That's really well said, Hamdan. In fact, I think that's how you'll leave your mark. You know, with AI, ambient computing, autonomy. We're in this new age of expansion, and Masdar is the kind of place where we actually see what technology can do for us. We can see the potential for sustainability.
Yeah, I'd say it's because you've put the human back in the loop. The way you integrate technology, it's not about being profitable or establishing leadership in that space per se. The tech is built around human and planetary needs. Anyways, all this to say, it was really fascinating to discuss this with you today.
We were very impressed.
That's so kind. Thank you. Mashkur wayed.
Oh, look at the time, though. We might need to leave you.
Of course, of course. I should call you a cab so you can get back to the airport.
Being here today makes me reconsider how the West approaches heat resilience because we're behind. I mean, sure, in this podcast, we've seen that there's a large community rallying around the issue of heat resilience, but we don't have our 2050 goggles on. And when you visit a place like the UAE, it's easy to think that they can afford innovation because they have money and space. But I mean, the UK is one of the wealthiest countries in the world. We're not missing the technology. We have the people with the skills to do it. So really, what are we waiting for?
I am sad to say your car is here, and I have loved showing you around. Take care, my friends, and safe journey home. تشرفنا بيكم. مع السلامة. مع السلامة. يا هلا.
So, Paula, have you enjoyed your trip to the UAE?
You know what? I was pleasantly surprised. I was actually a little apprehensive about the heat before coming here. I mean, I've spent hot summers in Rio, but this was something else.
I suppose the mercury is a little higher here. At least it's a dry heat.
That's so true. But on a more serious note, this trip has been a revelation.
How so?
Well, first of all, I was actually quite surprised at how many of the resilience technologies and techniques came from traditional practices.
I see. So, and I'm not trying to be sarcastic, what were you expecting?
When I first found out I was coming here, I had made some assumptions about how the Middle East dealt with heat. You know, the stereotype is extreme wealth and near endless resources, so I honestly thought we'd see expensive, high-powered solutions. Picture heat-radiating air conditioners.
Your worst enemy. But yes, I see, you were expecting solutions that don't interact with the local environment, but instead pummel the problem with money and refrigerants?
Well, kind of, yeah. But everything we've seen here has been some sort of innovation on a traditional method. And in the case of Masdar, they use energy sparingly and coming from renewables, which is amazing. If our urban centers around the world followed that model, it could be a massive relief.
Granted, they integrate the technologies.
Of course.
But I agree, those developments are huge. And you know, I loved that Hamdan said, we're making them knowing that global superpowers are watching. I mean, As it stands now, Abu Dhabi is probably, I'd say, a couple of steps ahead of the rest of the world in terms of building for a hotter future. That should encourage world leaders to not just pay attention, but start acting.
You know, something I worry about, though, is the question of wealth. The UAE has a lot of capital. It's also our case in the West. But other countries in Asia, Africa, or Latin America simply don't have the budget for infrastructure at the same scale.
Yeah, I understand that concern, but Hamdan showed us that heat resilience is powered by all sorts of tools, new and analog technologies. So, in regions where there's not enough money for the latest tech, we can cherry pick. Let's target essential issues and bank on traditional techniques to scale up.
Yeah, that makes sense. My other takeaway from this trip is something Hamdan said about the values of Islam and what motivates this move towards sustainability. He talked about stewardship and responsibility towards each other. And I think where there is more money and knowledge, there is a responsibility to share, to look after those who have less. As the world keeps heating up, we'll need to think about what it means to be heat resilient together, beyond borders.
It sounds like this trip was quite philosophical.
You know, it really was. And whatever we think of the Middle East and the UAE, they're leading the charge in heat resilience. There's plenty to be learned from the region.
And here you go. One fresh Gawa coffee. You've really acquired a taste for this.
You know, I wasn't sure about it to start with, but the cardamom is growing on me.
Well, I think I'll stick with the Americanos for now. So, Paula, after all this travel, you must be pretty used to boarding calls by now.
Oh, yeah. I've had my fair shares of that. But there's a pretty big difference between waiting in a departure lounge and waiting in the executive lounge.
Well, traveling with the boss does have its perks.
But seriously, each trip has really been a different adventure.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. So, what stuck with you?
Well, New York really stuck with me. Not just the skyline or the stories, but how so much of the city was shaped by private money. The High Line, Rockefeller Center, even Plan NYC, they all came from this blend of ambition, wealth, and political will.
Yes, it only works when everything lines up. How did you find Paris in comparison?
Very different. There, it was all about working with limits, tight streets, historical buildings, layers of regulation. They don't have the luxury of starting over, so they're innovating within constraints. It's like they're retrofitting resilience to the old world.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, policy takes the lead in Europe. That and Paris is known for the spirit and force of its people. And that's the thing, right? The old world is a system, both physical and moral, too. There are social codes. I'm sure you know what I'm going to say.
It's social architecture?
Exactly. Social architecture.
Knew it, but I agree. And in that sense, when I got to the Middle East, it was like flipping the page to a different book entirely. Here, the people's spirit, the local culture, it lands itself to constant change. I mean, Hamdan said this beautiful thing when we met. He said, we are built on sand. And it's true. Adaptation is all they know.
What an image. When it comes to heat resilience, cities are being designed for heat from day one. We can't ignore that.
Yeah, it's not an add-on. The materials, layouts, airflows, it's all built for 2050.
Actually, I'd go further. For them, 2050 is now. They are ready. They're in the future. That's what we should bring back to London. Resilience is something proactive. For old cities, it's no longer about reacting. It's about thinking ahead. And we have some catching up to do. I'm trying to think about how we implement this in Pegasus. So after everything you've seen, do you have some fresh ideas for how we can do that?
I think Pegasus can't just be a project. It needs to be a model, like a professional framework rather than another think tank or funding body. It needs to provide a structure that cities can apply to deliver resilience at scale. In New York and Paris, what worked was often a holistic approach. You bring together leaders, visionaries, deep pockets, and public support. You get everyone involved, and this approach works brilliantly. But in other countries, resilience is fragmented. A pilot here, a policy tweak there, with no clear structure to follow. That's where Pegasus should step in. And this trip made it clear. The future doesn't need another idea. We've got the ideas. We need an engine.
I'm inclined to agree. In my mind, Pegasus needs to move things forward with three major steps. First, let's make a clear, actionable roadmap, starting with what the city's already done. And from that, we pinpoint the gaps. Where should new interventions go? Where does the funding need to land? And which partners come in? We've done the theory. Now it's time to execute. Which brings us to step two. We make a demonstration project. Like we saw in New York, people don't engage with resilience unless they can see it and feel it. So, bring the issue to their front door. Let's build a London equivalent to New York's High Line. Wherever we work, we need to create a cultural moment or a public installation. Something visible that makes urban heat personal. Because if people don't care, policy won't matter. Once that's locked in, we move towards a long-term strategy. And that's step three. We turn the first intervention into a model, and we work on that for 3 to 5 years.
What I like about this is that this approach builds over time. It's an action plan that is delimited and simple, and I think that's what Pegasus is about. It should show the way forward step by step.
Will all passengers for flights BA-108 please make their way to gate B?
That'll be us, Paula.
Boarding passes and passports, please.
Grand. Another queue.
Paula. This isn't just any queue. It's the executive queue.
Oh, and I suppose that's executive leg tiredness I'm feeling, too.
Only the very best for you, Paula. You should try the margarita here. It might kick your travel fatigue.
Garth!
What a surprise. I didn't know you were here.
Actually, we're just passing through on our way to somewhere even more exotic.
And where's your partner in crime?
Yeah, I'm not sure I've ever seen you without Jay somewhere near.
Oh, I'm here. Somebody left their wallet in the restaurant and somehow talked me into running back to get it.
Meet Garth Pritchard and Jay Brooks, fast friends and food experts. Garth is a former food system consultant and has helped organizations and governments develop strategies to make their food systems more robust. Whether you want to scale your seedling production or upscale your crop logistics and delivery, Garth will have the answers. Jay, on the other hand, is the artist in this right brain, left brain pairing. His background is in culinary anthropology, and he holds a grand diplôme from the Cordon Bleu. The man is a walking food encyclopedia, and if you're lucky enough to be invited to one of his dinner parties, he pairs every course with a history lesson.
So, how are your travels, Paula? The office has been awfully dull since you've been gone.
It's been great. I've met so many fascinating people. I used to think of resilience as a structural thing, you know, engineering challenges, getting ready to respond to emergencies, unlocking funding, this kind of stuff. And even though these factors do play a part, resilience is also something more human. It's about being connected to each other, sharing knowledge, taking responsibility.
It's so funny to hear you say that. We've been working on a project too, and this idea came up. We've been investigating food systems around the world and asking the same question of resilience. You know, how robust our food systems are, what made our food culture change, and how as individuals we can adapt to promote our own health and longevity.
We've been going from kitchen to kitchen, get to grips with why we seem to have lost our cultural connection with food and how we can reclaim it so we can live longer, happier, and healthier lives.
That sounds fascinating. And honestly, I've been so caught up in urban heat, I hadn't even thought about food resilience.
Well, yeah, these questions have sort of snuck up on us. Sure, we hear about famines on the news, and every so often we might get a food scare like BSE or foot and mouth disease. But these questions have been around for years. You know, ultra-processed foods, organic versus inorganic agriculture, even people's understanding of how to cook, they're huge issues. But they don't really get the airtime.
Which is a shame because I think with time it means we've kind of missed the essence of food. So we're trying to find solutions to reconnect with food.
Kinda like what you're trying to do with your podcast, Paula.
Well, maybe you should give this audio reporting a try then. I have to say, it's been a great way to get to the bottom of a question. And with that, dear listeners, you guessed it, the time has come for me to pass on the mic. But before I go, I want to thank you for following me on this journey into the world of urban heat resilience. It was a privilege to take you around the globe and to learn what we can do together to change our attitude to heat. And now it's time we looked at it from another angle. So open your ears and your taste buds. Jay Garth, take it away.
Thanks, Paula. Oh, and what the? This sounds so different behind the mic.
I've got a feeling you're going to get used to it very quickly.
Well, would you like to expand on that or...
You're just a natural performer, Jay.
I'm not sure you mean that as a compliment, but just this time, I'll let it slide. So our next series is going to be all about food. This joyous, artful thing we need every day to grow. Food is colorful, flavorful. It's expressive, artistic, fragrant. It's our connection with loved ones.
And food is also science, believe it or not. It's a seed in earth that grows and sustains us. But do we sustain it?
I see what you did there.
Listen, I'm just finding out, but I'm pretty good at this. So, next season on The Philanthropist's Conversation, we're taking back the agency over our food system. We're talking about choice and joy and making food part of our next level of resilience movement.
We hope you stick around. Promise it'll be fun.
All right. And with that, we'll see you next time on The Philanthropist's Conversation.
The Philanthropist's Conversation is a podcast from Pegasus made in collaboration with the team at Lower Street. Research and content direction by Ivan C. Writing and production from Lise Lavati with the help of Sam Dattapollen and Ryan Sutton. Sound design by Alex Bennett. Voice acting, Yvette Morita Silva, Mo Heat, Nathan Tower, Alex Rose, and Rob Leland. The Philanthropist Conversation is a fictional piece based on real interviews with researchers, policymakers, and experts in the field of heat resilience. To continue learning about urban heat, head to the show notes to find the resources used in the making of this episode. We want to thank Lenio Miravilli for her valued contribution and Gerard Evenden for bringing his voice to this episode and for a privileged interview.